From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his book, which seeks to explain how pleasure works, the psychologist Paul Bloom makes a bold claim. Human beings, he says, start off with a fixed list of pleasures, and he says we can't really add to that list. At first, that doesn't ring true. What about newer pleasures like video games, water parks, dark chocolate? Bloom argues none of those pleasures are actually new. They're just new ways of connecting to pleasures we already have built in. At the heart of human pleasure, he says, is this idea of essentialism, that things have a true nature that can't be seen but that drive our sense of pleasure. Today in the program, Paul Bloom will join us to talk about pleasure, how the essence of a thing is at the heart of our passions, our appetites, and the way we sense reality. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. At first, the idea of pleasure seems simple. And if you break it down biologically, it seems elemental. We evolved to enjoy what's good for us. It's pleasurable to eat when we're hungry or drink when we're thirsty. Same idea can explain the pleasure of sex, that in the evolutionary sense, it's useful for us to help us reproduce. But in his book, Exploring Pleasure, the psychologist Paul Bloom says it's more complicated than that. Pleasure, he says, is complex, even transcendent. And he says there are all kinds of factors that go into it, evolution, culture, biology, and learning. This is more than just the simple pleasures of food or sex. Bloom says this is grounded in a belief about the essence of a thing. It's a conversation about philosophy, neuroscience, evolution, child development. His book is called How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like, and Paul Bloom is joining us today to talk about it. Paul Bloom is a professor of psychology at Yale University. He's written for publications like The New York Times and The Atlantic. He's the author or editor of four books, including Descartes' Baby, How the Science of Child Development Explains What Makes Us Human, and he's joining us today from his office in New Haven, Connecticut. And Paul Bloom, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
I guess maybe the best way to begin is maybe define our terms here. Explain what we mean by pleasure. Because as you say in the book, we're not just talking about sort of the pedestrian pleasures. You say in many ways it's more about kind of mysterious pleasures that you're getting at.
Right. I'm interested in the full range of human pleasures. So this includes pleasures that are seemingly simple and are shared with other animals like sex and food, as well as more complicated, maybe more uniquely human pleasures like artwork and stories and sentimental objects and religious ritual. And the argument I make throughout the book is that all of these pleasures, both the sort of seemingly obvious ones like sex, including more mysterious ones like the pleasure we get from mild pain, All of these pleasures share a certain interesting property, in that for all of them, the pleasure we get isn't just a result of our sensory experience. It isn't just a result of what we see or what we smell or what we touch, but rather it depends critically on our beliefs about what things really are. And I talk about this in terms of essentialism, our belief that things have a real deep essence that goes above and beyond their superficial appearance, and that this influences at a very gut level the pleasure we get from them.
What is it that got you started on this? What made you try to get at just how this works? Because you've been getting at similar kinds of questions in your other work.
That's right. My day job is as a developmental psychologist. I study kids, and I've long been interested in how children make sense of the world, how they name things, how they categorize things, their basic fundamental sense of what things are. And what my colleagues and I have been finding is that even at a very young age, children go beyond the superficial. What they call things, what they think of things, isn't just based on what they look like, but what they really are. So even a young child, for instance, knows that something might, look like a raccoon but actually be a skunk, look like a tiger but really be a lion. And I then got interested in children's artwork and found the same thing, that children can draw a picture that looks like nothing in particular, but they call it something. They say, "This is you, Daddy," or "This is a picture of my house or a dog." And they do so not based on what it looks like but based on what they intended it to be. And then that got me interested in a broader question of what about what they like, their pleasures? And in fact, there's a lot of evidence that even very young children are influenced in their beliefs about what something is when determining how much they like it. My favorite example is how do you make children like to eat carrots and drink milk? Not just prefer to eat and drink them, but say they taste better. answer is you pull them out of a McDonald's bag. They have a belief that, well, it must be good then. And then that got me interested in more adult pursuits. So it turns out that the same phenomena happens with adults, but this time it's not McDonald's. It's the label on a bottle of wine. You want to serve wine to some friends, and you want them to really enjoy it, really think it's terrific. Tell them it costs $200.
Yeah.
And that has a huge influence, not just on what we say, not just, say, oh, well, it must be good because it's so expensive, but just how you taste it. I'm not an uncritical fan of neuroscience, but there was one study I love where they got people inside an fMRI scanner, a brain scanner, and as they're in the scanner, they're sipping wine through a tube. And as they're doing this, they're looking on a screen, at a screen which has how much the wine costs. And it turns out, if they think they're drinking the cheap stuff, you don't get much of a neural reaction. But if they think they're drinking really expensive stuff, the pleasure centers of the brain light up like a Christmas tree.
Mm. So this is essentially about, this creates our own reality.
Absolutely. It says that what we, and this is an insight that Shakespeare had and Milton had, and it's that how we, you know, the mind can make a heaven out of hell, a hell out of heaven. What you think of something has a profound influence on how you experience it.
You make the argument that humans get a different kind of pleasure from certain activities than other creatures. So in some ways, is this what it means to be human? I mean, there's something quite different in the way we experience pleasure, humans and other creatures.
I think there is. I think that there's a shared foundation that we've gotten through natural selection. So in some way, human pleasures and the pleasures of non-human animals are a lot alike. There's a pleasure in food. There's a pleasure in sex. There's a pleasure in being safe, a pleasure of, you know, victory, a pleasure of being loved. But humans have additional qualities in that our pleasure is deep in a way that animal pleasures aren't. When my dog eats from her dog bowl, she doesn't care what she thinks the food is. It's just what it tastes like, its physical properties.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I eat from my plate, it matters critically to me what I believe I'm eating. And I think that opens up so many things. The depth of our pleasure makes possible artwork. It makes possible stories. It makes possible certain interesting masochistic pleasures. My friend and colleague Paul Rozin likes to say that the defining property of humans could be man is the only animal that likes Tabasco sauce. We seem to seek out mild pain because if you control it right and you think about it the right way, mild pain can be pleasurable.
Help us understand, Paul Bloom, how the distinction between how much of this is cultural, how much of this is part of our evolution. You don't make any. You say there are they go together, I guess, because there's this argument that, you know, these deep pleasures don't actually come out of biological evolution or from natural selection, that they're, you know, products of human culture. But you say that's not how it works. Even these deep pleasures, you say, have developmental origins.
I think so. I think that we tend to radically overestimate the influence and importance of culture and society in shaping our pleasures. At the same time, plainly culture and society influences our pleasure. The fact that I was raised in North America in a certain time has a lot to do with the sort of music I like.
Right.
If I was raised in India or parts of Africa, I'd like different music. It has to do with the sort of foods I like. You know, I like, you know, hamburgers and pizza and Coke and Pepsi and all those things. You know, and I don't like kimchi that much because if I was raised in Korea, my odds would go way up of liking kimchi. So plainly culture plays some role. But what you find is that culture ends up sort of moving you around within certain predefined constraints. So music will differ all around the world. But you'll never find a society of humans that enjoys the sound of static. Food tastes vary all around the world, but nobody likes eating dirt. And so on for sex, so on for stories, so on for art. So for art, for instance, people everywhere are very interested in where the art came from, who created it, under what circumstances, what does it mean. Now, the value you give to different aspects of its history, how much value do you give to creativity, how much to virtuosity, how much to distinctiveness, how much to veridicality, that will vary culture by culture and even person by person. But the general flavor of our taste for art is uniquely human.
Mm. You put it this way in the book. I wanted to ask you about, you say that the story of the depth of pleasure is the story of an accident.
I think so. So I'm arguing for the evolution, for an evolutionary approach for the way our minds work.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm not saying that all of our pleasures serve adaptively useful functions. I think to some extent what's happened is we've evolved essentialism. We look at the world in a deep way. And I think that is a biological adaptation. I think it's very useful for an animal like ours to be very interested in the hidden structures of things, and particularly the hidden structures of people. But once we have that in place, it can distort and elaborate our pleasures in ways that serve no reproductive good. So, for instance, one hallmark of one way which people work is when it comes to everyday objects, including consumer products, but also everyday objects, it matters critically to us who touched them.
Right.
I've done some experiments with colleagues of mine finding that people will pay a lot more for a sweater that they believe was owned by George Clooney than by Joe Blow, some normal person. It's worth more if it was worn by George Clooney rather than merely purchased by him, and it's worth less if it was washed before it got to you. You want his stuff kind of on the sweater. That's what gives it value.
Right.
I think this serves no reproductive value. I think this is an accident of the fact we're so interested in origins and so interested in people.
You say that that all these diverse pleasures now that we have, we're all over the map, human beings, in terms of the kinds of pleasures we have. But you say that there's a basic list, kind of a fixed list, and in some ways, we can't really add to that list. I mean, some of the diversions and other things play into some of these basics, but there are some basic pleasures we have.
That's right. I think because we're so interested in human differences, we tend to be obsessed with them and fascinated by them. But out of the space of activities that we could conceivably enjoy, it turns out just a tiny circle of them actually give us pleasure. And you could predict this from biological evolution. There are very few people who, say, get great pleasure by being rejected from somebody they love, or great pleasure from losing a limb. That's just not how we've worked. We work so that the pleasure we take is primarily in things that are reproductively advantageous for us.
Mm.
Things like orgasm, things like drinking water when you're thirsty, things like resting when you're tired, things like being loved. Like, you could take pride in accomplishments of your children. You could enjoy an exciting and interesting story. And so much of my book is about where we go from there, how we take these basic building blocks and expand them, often in very surprising, unexpected ways. But I would very strongly argue that we do start off with a fixed set of pleasures, and we don't really add to them. The human mind is not infinitely flexible.
We're going to come back around to this subject, but I wanted to mention also that included in these pleasures are transcendence, the idea of God and faith, which a lot of people, some argue is entirely or quite cultural. You say even here, this is explainable in those sort of fixed lists of pleasures.
I do. This is how I end the book, and it's I admit, the most speculative part of the book. But I'm very interested in the pleasures people take in religion. I've argued elsewhere in my previous book, Descartes' Baby, that a lot of religious ideas and religious notions, in fact, come natural to us. They're not direct adaptations, but they're easy for us to imagine. Our mind naturally assumes the existence of gods and spirits, and we automatically like to participate in rituals and different activities. Religion's a very natural activity.
Mm.
But I'm interested to hear in what pleasure we take from it. And I think part of the pleasure is that as essentialists, we're very interested in the experience of going beyond the world of physical things, the world as we see it. So religion scratches this itch. Religion provides mechanisms and belief systems that say that the world we're in is not the only world there is. And in fact, through prayer, through meditation, through dance, through all of these rituals, you can transcend this world. Now, religion isn't the only human practice that does it. Science does this too. I think science scratches this itch in some ways in a more satisfactory way by saying that the world as you see it is so incomplete, and we're going to explore what's really going on, the true essence of things, the true essence of the universe, the true essence of objects and animals and people. But I think so in that way, I guess I'm making a connection between science and religion, despite their many manifest and important differences. They're both different ways of scratching a certain itch, and they're both different ways of satisfying our need for the transcendent, our need for the essential.
Paul Bloom is with us. His book is called How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the psychologist Paul Bloom here to explain how pleasure works. How Pleasure Works is the name of his book. It's also the new science of why we like what we like. Paul Bloom, I want to get at a little bit more this idea of essentialism. One thing that you there's the story you use to explain what you mean by it, and it comes from this novella by J.D. Salinger, which helps you kind of explain this essence. Talk about that, if you would.
If I remember it right, it's a story of somebody who is sent to retrieve a certain sort of horse.
Yeah.
And he's a mystic, and he comes back with entirely the wrong horse, the wrong gender, the wrong color, but the person who sent him is dazzled because he says, "Look, I sent this mystic, and he wasn't trapped by superficial things, but actually he responds to the deep nature of the horse. You know, yeah. You should do as well." And it turns out that I think this nicely illustrates the notion of essentialism, which is that there's more to what things are than what they look like. Mm-hmm. There's more to being a dog or a cat or a tiger. There's more to being a chair or a desk. There's more to being a man or a woman than simple compilation of physical features. The reality behind a category is always deep. Sometimes for something like a chemical, the reality has to do with its molecular structure. For an animal, it might have to do with its DNA. For an artwork, it might have to do with what it was created to be, its history. Hmm. But we always look deep. And the contribution of my book was to take this finding, which is reasonably well established in the psychology of language and the psychology of concepts, and argue that this affects us at a gut level. Hmm. So alongside the story by Salinger, I tell the story I begin the book with the story of Hermann Göring.
Yeah.
And he was Hitler's second-in-command, and he was on trial at Nuremberg, actually sentenced to death for crimes against humanity. And he was a notorious art collector, collected all sorts of paintings, and he was told a few days before he was executed that his most prized artwork, which he thought to be by Vermeer, was actually a forgery by this great Dutch forger, Van Meegeren. And for him, this was horrifying. One biographer said, for the first time, he looked as if for the first time in his life he had realized there was true evil in the world. And I think that, you know, Göring was a horrible psychopath, but his reaction was normal. Mm-hmm. Imagine you had an artwork that you had thought was by a great artist, and you loved it, and discovered it wasn't what you thought it was. And what's interesting is you weren't deluded by what it looked like or how heavy it is or what it felt like. You were deluded by its history, its true nature. But this matters to all of us. I find in my work it matters to three-year-olds with their security blankets and teddy bears. They would get enraged if they're replaced by a duplicate. It matters for adults, even those of us who don't collect art. Everybody I know has some sort of sentimental object, their children's baby shoes, their wedding ring, and so on, which is valuable not because of its physical properties, but because of its essence, its history. Mm.
You know, I was interested in some of the experiments you referred to that showed young children, for example, you would have like a stuffed dog or something, and if you removed the insides of the dog, they don't see it as a dog anymore. But if you remove some of the outside features, it's still a dog. There's something inside a thing or a person that defines it, I guess?
That's right. These are some classic studies done on the nature of essences. Some of this work was done by my colleague, Frank Kyle. So what Frank did was he did experiments with young children, for instance, where he would take a porcupine and show them a series of pictures in which its outsides were molded and changed so that at the end of the pictures it looked exactly like a cactus. And he asked these kids, these 3 and 4-year-olds, what is it? And they say, it's a porcupine.
Yeah.
And they find it hilarious that anybody would think it's a cactus. Now, it looks exactly like a cactus, but they realize its innards haven't been changed, and it's the innards that matter. And so for physical things, for things like animals and plants, what really matters is the insides, the guts. For things, though, like human artifacts, like paintings and chairs and tables. What matters is also invisible, but it's not the innards anymore. What it is the history. So, for instance, you could show children, I've done this in my research, show four-year-olds two pictures that are exactly identical. But one of them was drawn with intent to draw, somebody's sister.
Yeah.
Another one was drawn with intent to draw somebody's mother. And they look identical. But children have no hesitation saying, well, that's the sister and that's the mother. And when children draw their own pictures, these pictures don't look like anything much at all when they're young enough, but they name them and they appreciate them based on what they, and on their history, their intentional history, what they had wanted them to be. And I think this is true for adults as well. For adults, our appreciation of artworks like paintings and statues rests critically on their history and who created them, why, under what circumstances, and what were they intended to be.
So it's more than just categorizing something. It's, you write about this kind of life force, that there's this essence within each individual that makes it special. And that's one of the reasons why, I guess, that helps us understand maybe our affection for celebrity culture or collecting, those kinds of things.
So, right. So the notion of essence is, you know, I've sort of given the sort of simplest possible notion, just something that makes something special that's invisible. But it gets expanded, as you're pointing out. And we get all sorts of elaborations of the notion of essence. And one aspect of it is the notion that that there is something to being a special person, a celebrity. And this something is often so powerful that it manifests itself and can spread. So objects that are in contact with a celebrity, John F. Kennedy, George Clooney, Mahatma Gandhi, these objects become special objects and people want them. Mere contact by a celebrity, eye contact, touch with a hand, is often very prized, and people will pay for it and fight for it. A different way it manifests itself is in our beliefs about organ transplants. So many Americans, for instance, when you're asked, believe that heart transplants and lung transplants don't just transplant a physical part of their body, but transplant a person's essence. So that, if you got a heart-lung transplant from a serial killer, that's kind of bad news for you, because some of the badness would end up infecting your own body.
Paul Bloom is with us. His book is called How Pleasure Works. Let's go to the phones. Darren is with us somewhere in Utah County. Darren, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
One of my favorite books is Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. And one of the conclusions that he draws is that, he was a Jewish prisoner of war during World War II. And he concluded that man can find meaning in great suffering. And I was just wondering Paul Bloom's insights into that and things that how he might explain that.
You understand pleasured. What do we understand about suffering, I guess, in that context, Paul Bloom?
Well, Frankl was a wonderful scholar, and I'm glad his name was brought up. He talked about his experience in the concentration camps and asked the question of what distinguished those who thrived and who survived these camps from those who didn't. And the answer he came up with was, survival was predicated on the ability to find meaning, to create meaning, to hold on to aspects of self and imbue this terrible day-to-day life with some sort of, real value, trying to find value in experiences others would find terrible. And I think that this is a wonderful, some wonderful observations of pleasure and of happiness in the most unlikely places. The question of pain is very interesting. Everything I think I've said about pleasure also applies to pain. So how bad something hurts depends a lot on what you think that something is. And a nice example of this comes from some studies done by Kurt Gray and his colleagues at Harvard, where they had people, undergraduates were given electrical shocks, mild electrical shocks. Half of them were told that they were just random shocks given by a machine, and they hurt a little bit, no big deal. The other half were told these were shocks given to them purposefully by somebody outside the room. And those hurt a lot more. Believing that your pain is a result of someone else's malevolence makes it much more painful. Then there's issues of control.
Yeah.
So stepping into a real hot bathtub slowly can be painful.
Right.
But people choose to do it. Now imagine you're going into the bathtub at exactly the same pace, but you're being pushed in. That's nightmarish.
Right.
That's terrible. And so, again, just as with pleasure, what you think you're experiencing the degree to which you believe you have control, the degree to which you believe something is social or non-social, has a profound effect on our experiences.
Darren, glad you called. I wanted to talk about some of the different domains of pleasure that you write about, some of the different chapters. You begin a chapter on food in a, I have to say, particularly disturbing way, with the story of an Armin Miwas?
Miwas, I guess.
Miwas, yeah. This is a 42-year-old computer expert, and the story is, as I said, pretty disturbing, but it's telling in a number of ways. To talk about it, if you would.
Yeah, I love that story, although more than one person has told me that I nearly stopped reading the book at that point.
Right.
It's a case of several years ago where what he did was he advertised on the web for people who wanted to be killed and eaten. And the first surprise of the story is many people responded to him, and he interviewed them, and he finally got this poor guy came to his farmhouse, and the details are not, I don't need to share them, but he ended up killing this person and eating him. And so this is cannibalism. It's consensual cannibalism of the sort, though he was eventually tried for murder.
Sure.
And the question is, where does this appetite for cannibalism come from?
Yeah.
And I think cannibalism is fascinating because it illustrates so many things. For one thing, it's a sort of a mystery. Why aren't we all cannibals? I mean, human meat is very rare. Meat is precious. So why aren't all societies cannibalistic? And I think part of the answer is, for both why we avoid cannibalism and why we sometimes seek it out, is that what we're eating, this what we believe our meat to be, matters critically for how we experience it. So on the one hand, if you're not a cannibal, you probably find the idea of eating humans to be repellent. It's the moral repellence of it affects how you would experience it, and you know, you couldn't bear to eat something which you believe to be a human arm, for instance. On the flip side, if you ask people why they're cannibals, both modern, you know, European and American cannibals, but also cannibalistic societies, they'll also tell you a story having to do with what it is. And they'll say that, by eating people who are respected and loved as they grow old and die of natural causes, you're honoring them. You're taking in their essence. And as a result, you're retaining their properties. The one story I include, just to show that cannibalism isn't entirely out of fashion in the modern world, is an interview of Keith Richards, who was once asked, and it's the strangest question in an interview. He says, "What's the oddest thing you've ever tried to snort?"
Right.
And which, you know, I've never been asked that myself in an interview. But he said, "My dad." His father was cremated, and Keith Richards mixed them up with some cocaine and snorted them.
Yeah.
So in some way, that's faintly sweet.
Yeah.
A sort of act of respect, I assume.
It's interesting, the idea of how we develop this sense of what is disgusting. And you wrote about this in Descartes' Baby. Disgust, you say, isn't something we're born with. But it kicks in at, like, age 3 or 4?
That's right. Disgust is absolutely fascinating topic. Babies are not disgusted by anything.
Yeah.
And you'd imagine that's a sensible way for them to evolve. The standard things that disgust people universally include body waste, urine, and feces. And since babies are not able to escape from their own waste, if they were disgusted, their lives would be misery. They'd be trapped in perpetual disgust. Disgust seems to kick in at some later point, age 3 or 4 or 5, and it extends to body waste, extends to rotten meat, extends to blood and guts and vomit, and it also extends to categories of people. And this is a way to bring back to your earlier question about culture. Culture can direct you to be disgusted at some people and not others. There are many people around the world at different times who've been disgusted at Jews, at women, at blacks, certainly at male homosexuals. All these people can elicit disgust. You could be disgusted at certain sexual acts, even at possibly some moral violations. You ask people who's disgusting, they'll say con men. Sometimes conservatives will say liberals. Sometimes liberals will say conservatives. It's not clear in those cases whether there's real disgust or just kind of nasty things to say about another group. But in any case, disgust is just fascinating because it's a very powerful, visceral emotion that extends to sort of fleshy things, but then has real-world consequences in that it shapes how we interact with strangers and it shapes how we interact with different groups.
Is there a what's the evolutionary biological connection to disgust?
Well, there's a controversy about that. Yeah. I think, and it's a view proposed by the scientist Dan Kelly, that disgust has two sources. One is avoidance of parasites, which is why you don't want to touch things that are disgusting. You avoid having any contact with your body because certain things are parasites, including other groups of people. Another aspect of disgust is a response to poison. And so this is why disgust is often a response involving retching and vomiting, and you don't want anything disgusting near your mouth, because we've evolved this particular response to things that if you ate them, you would be very, very sorry. And this includes feces, urine, it certainly includes rotting meat. And that may be the evolutionary origin of disgust. Mm. Then in contemporary humans, it gets expanded.
Yeah.
So you find certain classes of people disgusting, certain sex acts disgusting, and so on.
Back to the phones. Ray is with us in Salt Lake. Ray, welcome.
Thank you. Fascinating subject today. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Sparked a thought of those listening. You hear people oftentimes say, I have a high tolerance for pain, or pain doesn't bother me. And it got me thinking, is there a correlation between someone who has a high tolerance for pain? Does that mean they also have either a high or a low tolerance for pleasure? Or is there any parity, or does one affect the other?
That's very interesting. I can imagine, I don't know the answer to that, but I'll make an observation, which is, I think when people say they have a high tolerance for pain, it could mean one of two things. One is that they are not as sensitive as others to pain. It doesn't bother them as much. And I would bet, though I don't have data on this, that such a person would probably be less sensitive to pleasure too, simply because at a sensory level, their dial is turned down pretty low. But a second notion of high tolerance for pain is that you might get pleasure from pain. And you're thinking on the one hand of these heavy-duty masochists who like to be beaten and tortured, but even at a much lower level, the people who enjoy saunas and hot baths and very, very spicy foods and even horror movies and tragedies. And these people, I don't think, have a muted sensory experience. Rather, they have the capacity, maybe inborn, maybe kind of cultivated, to take things which are unpleasant and convert them into pleasurable experiences. And there I would expect maybe the correlation to go in an opposite way, which is somebody with a high tolerance for pain in that regard might actually get a lot of pleasure out of things.
Mm. You write about this kind of benign masochism. How do you explain the pain we get from pleasure and the pleasure we get from pain?
It's a huge puzzle.
Yeah.
It's a huge puzzle why people seek out painful experiences, hot foods and baths, and why we go to movies that make us cry or make us scream. I think there's many explanations. Maybe some set of them are right. So some of these are macho displays by men. We often will engage in these to show others how tough we are. I've seen middle-aged academics at an academic conference challenge each other to see who could eat the most wasabi sauce, for instance. And faintly pathetic, so that's part of it. A part of it is, I think, because pleasure has a time course. So imagine stepping into a very hot bath, and it's painful. But the moment the bath temperature drops enough so that it's perfect, it's blissful. And so you might suffer through the pain in order to get to that moment of bliss. I think the most interesting explanation for why we seek out these painful experiences is that, to some extent, they're a form of practice. So we're drawn, in general, to explore alternative realities, negative alternative realities, as in play fighting, where children fight for fun because they might have to fight for real later on. And I think, to some extent, we're drawn to, say, horror movies or tragedies as a way to vicariously put ourselves in bad situations, maybe to some extent to prepare ourselves for when we're in real bad situations later on in life.
Paul Bloom is with us. His book, How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. Ray, thanks very much for the call. Darren, you too. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with psychologist Paul Bloom. We're talking about his new book, How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. another one of those domains of pleasure you write about is sex. And I wanted to begin this part of the conversation with bed tricks, because that's how you sort of start that part. A bed trick is sort of a term coined by Shakespearean scholars for this event in fiction, something that happens over and over and over again. Talk about it.
A bed trick was coined to refer to something in which an event in which one person, in which you discover that the person you've just been in bed with is not who or what you thought they were. And Wendy Doniger has a wonderful book on the topic called Bed Tricks, which where she points out this shows up in every society, in every culture, in every genre, over and over again. Over in Shakespeare, the Old Testament is full of bed tricks, where you know Jacob goes to bed with Leah, but thinks it's Rachel. where Tamar disguises herself as a prostitute to seduce her father-in-law. This is just the stuff of soap operas, but it's the stuff of human drama. And I find it fascinating because it illustrates something so important about sexual desire and sexual pleasure, which is it's not just the bodies. It matters critically to us who we think we're with. There's one theme in the bed trick, for instance, is the horror that many straight men have if they were to discover that their sexual partner was actually male and had represented himself as female. And you might imagine, well, who cares? If you liked it, you liked it. But that's not the way the mind works. The mind works that it's critical who you think it is. A second example is in online pornography, where people go to tremendous efforts to find pictures, photographs of naked, partially naked celebrities. And often, you know, it's some blurry picture of somebody through a telephoto lens or a clip from a movie. But it's tremendously erotic because you know who it is. Suppose then you were to discover, oh, it's not this gorgeous movie star, but it's, you know, it's some tubby guy from a distance. Yeah. It would make a big difference. And so even something as seemingly primitive as sex is often very, very deep. It's often very much influenced by your belief system.
So it's moved from, I think you put it this way in the book, from the real world into the world of the imagination.
That's right. It's how you frame it. And it's not even it's even more general than simple sexual desire. So, for instance, you take a face, and the question is, how attractive do you find this face? Yeah. And it turns out you ask people just that question. Say, I don't want to know anything else. Just how attractive do you find a face? Not asking about a person. It turns out that you cannot help but see somebody as more attractive if you like them more, and see somebody as less attractive if you don't like them as much. A sign of happy marriage, and this has been studied in laboratory studies, but a different way of looking at it is a sign of a happy marriage is that each spouse thinks the other spouse is more attractive than other people think they are. And this is because if you love somebody, you'll think that they look good.
There's this fascinating disorder that you write about. I'm not sure how it's pronounced. Capgras?
I think it's Capgras syndrome.
Yeah, Capgras syndrome. The sense of attraction of familiarity doesn't just reduce to what somebody looks like. There's more to it here. Again, this idea that there's an essence. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, I end the chapter on bed tricks with a wonderful case study based on a woman who had Capgras syndrome. Capgras syndrome is a rare but attested neurological disorder where you come to believe that the people you love most in the world aren't who they really are, but they're duplicates. If you had it 100 years ago, you would think that they're demons or monsters. If you have it now, you'll think that they're robots or aliens or CIA agents hiding themselves or something. And normally it's terrible. Often people with Capgras syndrome have actually killed or injured those, their wives, their husbands, their children, because they think that they're attacking a duplicate.
Yeah.
But I end the book with kind of a sweet and romantic story. It's a woman who was very dissatisfied with her boyfriend, viewed him as a sexual dud. You know, lost interest in him, was totally uninterested in him. The relationship was going down the tubes. Then she got Capgras syndrome. And, of course, it's the same guy. But all of a sudden, she saw him as a stranger. And as the doctors who studied her, this is the 1920s, reported, she told them she had lost her boyfriend, but she found this new guy who looked familiar to his boyfriend. In fact, her boyfriend may be a twin. But unlike her boyfriend, he was incredibly attractive. He was virile and vivacious and sexually dynamic. And she fell in love with him all over again.
Paul Bloom is with us again. How Pleasure Works is the name of the book. Let's go back to the phones. Susan is with us. She's been waiting in Cedar City. Susan, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Oh, no problem. I just started to drive. Let me stop for just a second. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to say, first of all, that I'm an Episcopal priest, and I'm fascinated with many aspects of what you are talking about today.
Thank you.
But in particular, of course, I'm interested in the pleasure in religion, because the way I became a priest and the way I returned to the Episcopal Church after thinking that church really didn't have anything to offer was to read Marcus Borg's books, and who was on Monday on this show, and read from other theologians who are really after in a very different experience of God than what we grew up with as this mean guy with a long beard who had all kind of rules for us. So what I try to do on Sundays is try to make an experience of living in community with a radically loving God, is what I put on the paper, and really try to have the language, the things we do, the movement we do, be something that is totally pleasurable. So, comment.
Yes.
That's fascinating. I think I had originally talked about religious pleasure in terms of the pleasures of transcendence, but you're pointing out that there's related pleasures and there's other ways, other reasons why religion may draw people. I think some of them are faintly sinister. Some of them are wonderful. Mm. There's one that neither of us have spoken about, which I'll just add, which is one of the pleasures of religion, I think, is its social nature. It's not just participating in ritual. It's not the beliefs. It's not the transcendence. But it's with a community of like-minded people who care about you. And in contemporary America, that itch is often scratched by a church or a synagogue or a mosque or some sort of religious community. I think it's one reason why to be an American atheist is a faintly difficult position, because you don't have the same sort of social community at your ready, and you're often rejected by existing social communities. So religion, I mean, just to sum it up, religion offers all sorts of pleasures, and so it's no doubt that it's such a popular, I think, near universal human activity.
Yeah. Susan, thanks very much. Another domain of pleasure is art and performance. And this section, you begin with a compelling story. It's the story some of you may have heard of this young man, not known to the people of the who were getting off of the subway in this Washington subway station, but who had come to play the violin.
It's a lovely sort of experiment done by Gene Weingarten, this reporter for the Washington Post. His article, which ended up, I think, winning a Pulitzer Prize, was called Pearls Before Breakfast. And the idea was, how would people respond to great art if they didn't know it was great art? So he enlisted Joshua Bell, who was this wonderful violinist who people would spend a fortune to hear perform. And he somehow got Bell to agree to play in a Washington, D.C. subway station with, standing there playing with his case open in front of him, and see how much money he would make. This guy who's like the best in the world as people walked by.
Yeah.
And the answer was, he made about, $38.
Right.
The sort of average that somebody gets for that amount. He actually made $20 more, in fact, because it didn't count, though. This woman came by at the end of his performance, snobbed, stared at him. And it turned out she had seen him a little while before in the Boston Symphony Orchestra and paid a bundle for her seat. So she's looking at this guy in the subway station. She reaches into her purse, takes out a 20, walks over to him, drops in his case, and says, "I'm so sorry you're down on your luck." But what Weingarten points out, and I think this case nicely illustrates, is that it sounds different to you if you think it's by Joshua Bell versus by some scruffy guy in jeans on the Washington, D.C. subway station. And I think more generally, it's a fact about art, performance art, but also static pieces of art like paintings, that who they come from, who you believe they come from, matters critically. And I don't think it reduces to snobbery. I think it's just sort of a fundamental aspect of our appetite for these things, that our appetite is not an appetite for certain sounds or certain physical properties. It's an appetite for certain sorts of social performances, certain people. And so it matters critically who you think the performer is.
And not just that, but also we want to know that some effort went into it. That seems really important there as well.
Absolutely. And there's laboratory studies, some nice work done at NYU. I'm finding that to a certain point, the longer you think a painting took to paint, the more you'll like it. And in general, if it's something that's difficult to do, you tend to think there was more of a performance in it than if something was easy. One reason why some people hate Jackson Pollock's art is that they believe it's anybody could do it.
Yeah.
My kid could paint that. And if somebody says to you, my kid could paint that by splashing paint on the wall on a canvas, they're not going to be very impressed. Zero effort, zero skill means a lousy performance, means lousy art. People who love Jackson Pollock say, you know, this guy, it is so hard to do this. It is so difficult. It is so intense. The importance of effort even extends to our own creations. So there's something that some psychologists have called the IKEA effect. And the IKEA effect is, if you make it yourself, you value it more than if you just bought it as it is. Things that we've put together for ourselves, even if it was minimal effort, we think are worth more money, we get more pleasure from, we think are better. And so I think the history of something, in this case the effort, always matters for what we think of it.
Let's go back to the phones. Will is joining us in Salt Lake City. Will, welcome.
Hi, my question actually relates to a previous Radio West show about that compared the pleasure acquired from watching an episode of The Simpsons and the pleasure acquired from listening to a Hamlet soliloquy. And I'm just curious what the author would feel is different between those two pleasures, or how they might relate, or, maybe if they're not even different at all.
They're different in all the obvious ways, but I would say in a deep way, they trigger the same mechanisms. They trigger a social appreciation of what's going on. They trigger all sorts of thoughts and ideas. And mostly what they affect us because we get in the head of the person creating this. Either, you know, the person writing the material, the Shakespeare, the person who wrote for The Simpsons. And we get pleasure from connecting to that person. So to some extent, this is what we said about musical performances or everyday objects. The experience of Shakespeare or The Simpsons is to a large extent a social experience where we make contact with and we appreciate the genius of their creation.
Will, glad you called. Thanks very much. I want to talk about imagination. It's another important part of the book. And I was so intrigued by this idea of us having multiple selves, this idea that the brain is composed of these two different kinds of people, I guess. Each side is sort of competing with the other.
It's a somewhat radical way of looking at the brain, looking at the mind. But I think it makes sense. I think it makes sense to view each of us as, to some extent, a collection of different cells that have competing desires. And maybe the quickest way to illustrate this is to go to a sort of pleasures we don't like very much, like addictions, the pleasure of eating too much or smoking cigarettes or pornography or alcohol or pills. And there, we indulge in them even though we don't want to. So how do we make sense of this? One answer is that there's more than one person in your head. So there's a person who wants to smoke and a person who doesn't want to smoke, and they're fighting it out. The person who wants to smoke will sneak cigarettes. The person who doesn't want to smoke will say to his friends, look, no matter how much I beg you, don't give me a cigarette. And then the person who wants to smoke comes in later on and says, hey, forget what I said, pal. Just hand the cigarette over. And many of us live lives in constant battle between these different selves. And the problem is the self who wants to smoke or overeat or do all sorts of nasty things is often very smart and very good at getting its way. So much of pleasure is involves an internal battle between a self that desires short-term pleasures and is willing to work very hard to get them, and then another self that says that there are bigger things in life than pleasure. And although I wrote a book about pleasure, I don't think pleasure is the be-all and end-all. I think that there are larger life goals we might want to satisfy. And then so we are right to try to fight off the inner self that's simply a hedonist.
Mm. Let me ask you this finally, and I know you get this question all the time. How has writing a book about pleasure changed the simple pleasures you find in your life?
It's a good question. I would say I have only one practical implication of my work that's come to me. which is that because it turns out that even the simplest pleasures are so affected by our beliefs and our desires, by what we know, I think that the key to getting more pleasure out of life, and this is a very professorial thing to say, but the key to getting more pleasure is to learn more about things. If you want to enjoy wine more, the trick isn't to go to your wine store and then buy a bunch of expensive bottles. It's to take a wine tasting course. If you want to enjoy movies more, it's to learn about movies. Classical music is far more pleasurable once you know a lot about classical music, and so too for art. From every pleasure, from the sort of animal-like to the most uniquely human ones, our knowledge and understanding affects it. And so the practical upshot of my book is to increase this knowledge as a way to enhance your pleasure.
Paul Bloom, his book is called How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. He joined us from his office in New Haven, Connecticut. And Professor, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the show directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.